we're already rocking and rolling, but let's maybe kick it off with an official start. For those who don't know you, introduce yourself and your training background.
Oh, all right. So we totally got carried away, but yeah, it's great to finally talk to you again, Zach. So my name is Mark Limbaga. I'm based here in the Philippines. I'm actually in the northern part of the metro, Quezon City, to be specific. And my background. So I was, as I jokingly say, the skinny kid who wasn't born with the body of a jock, but always had a passion for movement. So that's how I got into doing the physical stuff, because I wanted to see what I could do. And along the way, when I was training at a gym, when they opened up an internship, that's where I threw my name in the hat, if I could apply. And then I got accepted. A month or two after the internship, they had an opening and they took me on board. So that's the short version of the long version, because after that, a few years later, that's when I got my kettlebell cert, and the rest is history, as they say.
Right on, man. What was it about kettlebell training that spoke to you? You know, I think it's like I get this question all the time, and and I almost have like a stock elevator pitch answer. So it's a question that I like to pose on my other kettlebell nerd friends, and you're definitely on the short list of the biggest kettlebell nerd friends I think I've ever spoken to. So
yeah. Okay, so I loved reading a lot about different methods in training back then. If you recall, in the late 2000s, when the term caveman training became such a hit. So back then, since I was also dabbling into MMA and jiu-jitsu, so I remember we were already using the sledgehammers, the tires, and all those other unique elements, for lack of a better term. What happened was I found two books. I found Power to the People, which I was already reading. Then I found Enter the Kettlebell. So I searched high and low for a kettlebell here in our side of the globe. Found one, tinkered a bit with it because I wanted to see what it could do. And then I happened to land on this book called Kettlebell Muscle by Jeff Newport. And I was already doing complexes with a barbell back then. So I said, hey, since this is something I already do, maybe I should try doing this just so that it won't feel that different. And that was around the holiday season of, I believe, 2010. And I ran that program. What shocked me was, of course, it's a holiday season, is we were not really that watchful of what we eat. But the fact is, I put on some muscle, and pun intended, and I still didn't gain that much body fat. And then when I started touching the barbell again, it kind of blew me away that I didn't touch a barbell for 6 weeks and I didn't lose any strength. So that became the hook.
Yes. The what the hell effect.
Oh, yeah. That's it.
As they say, you get sometimes bigger and simultaneously leaner and simultaneously stronger and simultaneously better at other skills, other strength endeavors. And yeah, that's what gets us hooked. And so that kind of all-in-one package, when you really experience it, when you really take the time to take, you know, 3 months or more to really dig into the techniques, dig into the complexes, the practice work. Obviously, Jeff Newport and so many others have such like iconic programs that just require some time, usually high frequency. So you're putting your hands on kettlebells just about every single day. And if you can really dedicate yourself to training the basics hard, and really ingraining the fundamental techniques, specifically in our neck of the woods, the hard style techniques.
Mm-hmm.
If you undergo that process, you're almost guaranteed to be hooked. I don't really know anybody who's put in 3 to 6 months of really hard, dedicated kettlebell training and then come out the other side saying, it's not for me, or it didn't do anything mm-hmm. for me. I've never heard it happen.
Yeah, I think the key word is dedicated, because you really have to dial in your technique. You really have to find your groove, so to speak, and then put in the work, because it doesn't happen like overnight. But then once eventually you start to get your technique, you start, and then now you could start slowly step on the pedal. You'll be so surprised at what you can unlock.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a journey that, I myself am still on. I'm still finding, I'm still finding different ways to approach the same old moves.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can go in with that attitude of what else can I get out of the basics, you'll be surprised on what might come out on the other end of that. And I think so many people have this mentality of, I need a new exercise, or I need a new widget, I need a new tool, I need a new program, new methodology. And sometimes I think there's definitely a time and a place for that. I would say, probably every 3 to 5 years, there's some kind of big new kind of thing. Or maybe a new way of looking at an old thing that fundamentally, unlocks a new level of skill or strength or athleticism. But apart from that, it's the attitude that you take and bringing that kind of beginner's mind and that dedication to every single workout is something that I try to remind myself of and certainly my clients of all the time. And it really makes all the difference.
Oh, yeah. So, since you mentioned like circling back to something after a few years, like in my case, since last year, I have, since gyms open, I've been able to touch a barbell again. And because we remember like how all of us during the pandemic did not have a full set of whatever. So we had to make do with the space that we were given, right? So during that time, I could not touch a barbell because I didn't have space where I train. And then when the gym started opening up again, since I consult at a gym, then that's the only time. And like recently, I've been trying to learn, like relearn and explore some different setups, different cues of some of the different lifts. And it makes a lot of sense now, because there are things that when, let's say, the naturally athletic people, the naturally strong do it, there are things that they can do, but they can't explain it or teach it right. So, like, for example, with the barbell squats, I've been learning like how to brace properly. And now I remember when I was explaining it to some of my students before, while it kind of made sense. And now when they do it, they say, now I know what you mean. It makes a lot more sense. So even the teaching progressions and whatnot. So it's always good to circle back. You're right. There's always this thing that you could look at with a fresh perspective.
Yeah, even something as fundamental as breathing and bracing. This is another thing mm-hmm. that I was talking with this friend of mine who's just getting started in coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was kind of talking about one of the big revelations, so to speak, in his training over the past year was really learning how to brace.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I've been doing barbell stuff, I've been doing kettlebell stuff for a number of years, but I never really got the brace until, mm-hmm. 6 months ago or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, man, it's funny. If you don't have that, mentor or that coach in your corner, or you skip that article on like how to brace, mm-hmm. well, you quite literally have this fundamental gap in your movement skill toolbox. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you can get pretty darn strong without ever thinking about how to tighten mm-hmm. your abs, so to speak. Yeah. But then once you get that skill, suddenly it can supercharge mm-hmm. everything else. And breathing and bracing and how you breathe and brace and tighten mm-hmm. up again can make all the difference. And you know, there's I think the further you go and the more techniques you learn, it's like there is no like right or wrong. There's just different applications mm-hmm. for a lot of these things. And that's yeah. one of the cool things is how do you, again, the barbell squat that theoretically everybody should know or that everybody's done for a number of years. What can you insert into the training process to make it new again? And breathing mm-hmm. and bracing and things like this are a way to refine that.
Yeah. And you all, as you said, you have to find what works for you. So I often say like some drills or some cues are like suits. I think I said this years ago. I can't recall what year, but they have to fit you right. Because let's say one cue that resonates with me so well, if I give it to you, it just doesn't connect with you. But then when you give you another cue, it just makes so much sense to you that now you understand it. So that's, yeah, going back, that's also the value that you get when you're getting coached and just not like looking at numbers or a spreadsheet. So it's often good that you also talk shop with different colleagues or find a good set of training partners, because those extra sets of eyes often gets you faster to where you want to go. It's like you can't fake wisdom, you can't fake insight. This is something that you'll know someone got through a lot of years in the trenches, so to speak.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that time in the trenches means more than what people realize. You know, it's like I didn't even really feel like I knew anything about training, probably until I hit about, you know, 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, you think about the average personal trainer barely lasts 8 or 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even really feel like I'd really come into my own as a coach until mm-hmm. until 8 or 9 years, which is in very recent history. So mm-hmm. it's about putting in that time. And again, just going back to the example of talking to my buddy who's getting started, you know, I told him like the best thing that you can do is just start working with people. Because the only thing at the end of the day that you can guarantee is that your 1,000th training hour is going to be better than your first.
Mm-hmm.
I can't necessarily give you the one book or the one article or the one workshop or the one course or whatever that's going to make you great on, you know, session number 2.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know the way to guarantee greatness is to get to session number 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no shortcut to doing that apart from
mm-hmm.
keeping your book full, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. I have a friend. I also co-teach with him. He's also a kettlebell instructor. And he met up with a friend of ours in Malaysia. Late last year, I think around the fall, and he was asking our friend, so what's the best advice you could give me since I've been coaching for a few years now and I'm an independent? And our Malay friend said, well, expect for the first few years it's going to be a struggle. You're really going to have to grind it out, and I can't guarantee you when, but if you stay the course, that's when you'll find your groove and eventually, and hopefully you will hit your pay dirt.
That's it. Yeah. You don't find the buried treasure if you're not digging.
Yes.
I know that's very much a platitude, but that goes for business. That goes for training. That goes for the business of training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I'm still experiencing that, you know, to this day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got all sorts of various goals, personal and professional goals. Mm-hmm. And yeah, 5% of the time, you feel like you're punching the clock. You feel like, at least I'm speaking for myself here, I feel like I'm punching the clock. I feel like nothing's really happening. And then that 5% of the time where you look back and you're like, wow, look at how far I've come in a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And B, every now and then, mana drops from heaven and you hit mm-hmm. that fast lane, and suddenly, you know, you pick up a client who suddenly has three more referrals for you.
Yeah.
Or you put out that Instagram post that goes viral, or, mm-hmm. you know, you go in and you hit that unexpected PR.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, you know, you just have to, again, it sounds so cliche, but you have to just be dedicated to the process to be able to catch those blessings when they come your way.
Yeah.
And that's one of the drawbacks, I think, of social media. I'm not mm-hmm. saying anything new here, but social media is just full of people's gems, of their highlights, mm-hmm. of their blessings. And then you start to think, oh my gosh, everybody else makes it look so easy and they're just winning and every, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's why it's also important to have real, you know, oh gosh, it's important to have real friends in real life to mm-hmm. ping real life ideas off of
mm-hmm.
and not be so influenced by people on a screen that
mm-hmm.
you have no context for what their life actually entails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's a little insight I think I would love to share with some of the readers and our listeners, sorry, because one of the struggles, of course, for us is, as we want to help as many people as we want, but we can't help everyone, right? And at the same time, for example, when we're picking up that client or this new student, there are those who we see that they're dedicated, but there's a struggle, right? Like how they're probably, like, let's say, working a blue collar job that just is just enough to pay the bills, but you could sense that they have the dedication, because when you interviewed and when you talked, you could really sense it. And this is something you develop, like you say, along the lines, along the years, when you're training people. So I remember sometime last year, there was this one kid. He was in college, probably a college sophomore or a college junior, and he really wanted to work with me. And he wasn't going to some of the prestigious schools, so I knew that this kid was living off faith. So I said, all right, here's what we can do. I will ask you to show up once a week where I teach, and then we'll work on some techniques. We'll work on whatever we can. And then the rest of you go to the other gym where you train. I'll just tell you what, I'll give you something to do, and then you know, just message me. And then through our conversations, I've apparently found out he was like a preacher's kid, and he was playing in their band, and he just really loved training. And I mean, whenever people would ask about how much I charge or whatnot, I mean, I always look back to that lesson, because it was really cool that it was my first time to train a kid of that background. But his dedication was so amazing that he was saying that he wanted to hit some PRs, and he hit a PR on his deadlift within a month. So he was pulling around 315 with a belt when he started me. A month after, he added 15 pounds and he pulled it without a belt. So I said, because we just worked on the technique and that's all we did. So I said, all I'm going to do with you while you're here is I'm not going to give you any program or whatnot. I'll probably just give you some like articles to read. And then if you have questions, you come back to me. But what I'm going to do is to give you your money's worth is I'm going to teach you work your technique, teach you some of the things that you're not seeing when you have me. And that's all it is to it. So sometimes, I mean, you just have to throw the dog a bone, so to speak, but also be selective, because of course, time is our most valuable asset in our industry.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. I would say probably in my first 2 years of personal training, I probably did as many or more. I definitely did more. I definitely did more free hours of training than I did paid hours of training.
Paid hours, yeah.
Like, I think 100%. Now, in my case, it was, you know, a matter of like, you know, trying to get lead generation and and that whole thing. So it's a slightly different conversation. But then, you know, yeah, on the other side, that's sometimes really, really tricky, is wanting to help everybody and either realizing that you're not the best fit, they're not the best fit, timing, life circumstances, obviously, obviously crop up. And yeah, that's super duper tough. Because as the, I think the gerbil in Dr. Doolittle said, you can't save them all, Hasselhoff. Yeah. So I think most of us as trainers have some sort of, call it savior complex, call it the David Hasselhoff complex, where it's our job to sit there in the lifeguard station and help anybody who's in the water. And sometimes you can't, sometimes people don't want to be helped. And that's probably the, you know, at the end of the day, this is a great gig. It is a pretty easy gig, relatively speaking. But that is probably the hardest part, is dealing with people for who, whatever reason, it's not clicking or it's not working, and you're putting in everything that you can. But such is life.
Yeah, it's a transaction. It's a business. I remember telling a student this since, I mean, he's been with me for a while now. I consider him a friend. And I told him that the best way that you can avoid frustration and disappointment, because at that time he was working at a job that he hated. So we run jokes about it all the time now. But so I told him, just remember that everything is a transaction. So the moment you kind of pin your hopes that someone, you assume and expect someone would do something or behave a certain way, and then they don't, and it gets you all angry and whatnot, then you're on the losing end. So I just say, always treat it as a transaction, that you don't take anything personally.
Sage advice. Sage advice. And fortunately or unfortunately, people are irrational. You know, if, you know, here's the thing. If we were all perfectly rational beings, the alcohol industry would not exist.
Yeah, and that's all the sage advice.
Yes. Well, one that I should probably take a second look at. But
yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's funny. My first PT manager, when I asked him about books that I should read, he was an interesting character. But he suggested the book Predictably Irrational. And I remember reading that book, and it was a bit of an eye opener, because it's all about the various ways that human behavior is expressed irrationally, very much backed up by data, up and down. And certainly it gives you an interesting new lens and a new perspective. And it's important to understand that, and also to understand that in a way where you don't take things personally. Also understanding it in a way to utilize that knowledge as a tool to help people.
What's the title of the book? Perfectly Irrational?
Predictably Irrational.
Predictably Irrational. Yes, I think I'm going to have to take a look at that. So here's something that you might find, because I often jokingly say that I'm a nerd. I'm a geek at heart. And I mean, one of the benefits of being in such a category is when you figure out how to use some of the quirky and unconventional stuff in what we do, it can also make you a better coach.
Totally.
Yeah. So, totally. Yeah. if I don't know if you're familiar, but one of like the joke nowadays is for the millennials and the Gen Z people, the Myers-Briggs and the Enneagrams are like their equivalent of the Zodiacs for the Gen Xers, right?
Right, right.
So I mean, during the pandemic, everyone is bored. So I learned a bit about it, studied it, and then like I would sometimes explain to some of my students, so what's your profile again? So they would give me their profile and their Enneagram and whatnot, and I would be explaining. So this is why I train you this way, because this is like your core fear, this is your core driver. I mean, and then I would say that, you know, I jokingly say, okay, let me remind you, I'm not a psychologist or a therapist, nor do I play one online. Then. But I do have a minor in behavioral science. So, but we're just using just enough the surface level that it serves the purpose that, which is so that we can develop a better student-teacher relationship, that we could work harmoniously. That's basically all there is to it. And, but then it became really fun because they would realize, oh yeah, so that explains why, blah, blah, blah. And then I would give like certain characters, fictional or famous characters. And then I would say that, remember that these sometimes we get carried away by the stereotypes. And I would say that, like, I would jokingly say, like, the stereotype of my profile is we're supposed to be like the golden retrievers. Then I jokingly say, but I think I'm not a golden retriever. And then they would definitely start laughing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I've certainly dove a little bit into Myers-Briggs and Enneagram. Mm-hmm. And I've gone so far as to take, you know, like the, you know, full half hour questionnaire and exam, and gotten like the 10-page report all about my psyche and my personality. And it very much scratched a narcissistic itch just reading about yourself for 10 pages and, oh, look how great I am and all these things. Mm-hmm. And maybe I skipped over some of the areas for improvement.
So so what profile did you get?
Well, if you're, let's see, so for the Enneagram, would you like to guess?
I think you're a seven.
Interesting. What is the seven?
The seven is the person who's more of the in the moment. They don't really dive too deep on things. They're not really that, I would say, obsessed. Because like for me, I'm an eight, so the eight is the traditional nonconformist.
Oh, right on. I like that.
But I mean, just because of what I see with you, I mean, I always say Zach must be an ENFP 7. That was my guess.
Well, you know, I very well may be, but according to my test that I took, I am a 3.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Same as my wife. You're a 3.
All right. Well, that must be why you like me so much.
I have the only one I haven't met that's confirmed is a 9, but because the 9s are the ones who are very, I would say, the capybaras of the Enneagram world.
Okay. All right. In what respect?
Yeah. I mean, because they're so laid back. They're the peace key. They're like the peace lovers. The 3s, you guys are the go getters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe my moniker was the achiever.
Yeah, that's it. Achiever. So 3s and 8s usually get along.
Right on.
Yeah, ones are the perfectionists, the, as they jokingly say, the principals.
Oh yes, right. Yeah, it's funny. It's fun to even if you don't put much stock into personality tests, it's fun to play around with these ideas. And you know, I'm always kind of thinking about how AI and technology is going to change things, specifically the way that we do things.
Yeah, of course.
And I can very much see a time, probably in the not too distant future, where as part of the onboarding process for training, everyone takes some sort of personality exam, and that the AI program will spit back, you know, talk to your client in this way, maybe say these things in this way during these times and whatnot. So that, you know, stuff like that might be coming down the pike. And that, on the one hand, that's creepy. all this AI technology stuff is very creepy. But hopefully it helps us all get along better and makes us all more effective and efficient.
Yeah, I think there's a time and place that, yeah, we definitely would need technology because it will serve us. But I still believe that moving forward, the human interaction and the ability to make quick decisions is something that AI will probably still not replace. Because I remember, I think it was Nick Tominello who said it. Like, you know that feeling when you are calling, let's say, the trunk line, the helpline, and you just, then you say, if you're a new customer, press 1. If you're an existing customer, press 2. And then you waste so much time when you couldn't have just spoken to the representative, which would take 2 minutes and you're done.
Right. Right. Yeah. Unintended consequences.
Yes.
Feature creep. And then having to, segment yourself into XYZ bucket to just get help in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. That would, I mean, that wastes so much time. But yeah, it's interesting because that's what's happening with some things now. I mean, even in, I think, 2016, when I remember a friend was saying that, maybe in the future, every way you train people is just automated. Then I said, for some it will work, but not everyone. Because I'm sure there you have like some people you train that, if you're traveling, you could have either, you could leave them something to do and they'll do it. And then there are some that they need you. So you could zoom in, or if not, you have someone fill in for you. I mean, I'm sure you know these different types of clients that we have. So that's another topic for another day, which is really interesting. But yeah, not everyone would just want to be following something from a computer.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. One of my clients, you know, I see clients in home, in their home. Yeah. So I'm a bit of a concierge, personal trainer, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I am at this one particular client's house Monday through Friday, either coaching the husband or the wife. And I am in a room. I am in the home gym that has a Peloton, that has a mirror. If you've seen like the mirror follow along the fitness gadget, DVD player, all a bunch of fitness DVDs, laptop, access to the internet, all the exercise, all the workouts you could want. On demand, on the internet, DVD player, the big flat screen TV, all this technology, all this exercise equipment. And they know how to exercise. They know how to train. I am like the most expendable piece of the puzzle. Like,
they need you there.
But they need me there. Or at least they want me there. And that just goes to show the power of the right fit. And again, maybe kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, just the importance of being a people person.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned it, that you train someone in their homes. And I wanted to say this to, like, if I ever bump into another up-and-coming trainer who's just dipping his or her hands into coaching, I would say that here's one thing that social media has never said. In my experience, the meal ticket, if you are training people, is to train your clients at home, because you could charge double what you charge in the gym, or even triple, depending on how far you travel. Now, if you get 4 of those, let's say, for example, I'm just making a wild guess here, let's say Nashville, you charge $50 an hour. If you go to someone's home, you could easily charge $100 to $150, even as high as $200. Now, if you put the numbers, you train someone in their home, you have 4 clients, that's what? $2,400 in a day, something like that. Or $600 a day. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, you have that, and you fill that schedule up, then you basically got it made.
Yeah, man. I am not complaining. It has its pros and cons.
Oh, it does.
But yeah, I almost didn't even really choose the in-home thing. It was almost, it was not even almost, it was by necessity. I just could not find opportunity in the gym settings that I was in. And I worked for some amazing gyms over the years, and they were all great in their own ways, but obviously all limited in their own ways. And yeah, I'm very blessed, and I'm very lucky that, you know, one in-home client turned into two, turned into four, turned into eight. And it's a very interesting thing, because environment is everything.
Yes,
when someone
right.
comes to you, it's the client is coming into your environment where you are the boss.
Yes.
When you go into someone's home, it's a fundamentally different dynamic.
It's a different setting.
I mean, certainly you're there to be an authority and to be an expert and to, you know, lead the charge and everything. But yeah, it's something that that was a real trip for me when I very first got started, because I was just used to just being the head honcho in the gym, and you come to me and you're playing by my rules, and this is my space and blah, blah, blah. And it's not exactly that way when you're in someone else's living room and it's their dogs on the floor and it's their phone that's ringing and it's their neighbors or delivery guys that are coming by and their TV that's on, you know, their thermostat that they like to keep warm or cold. And that's all cool. You know, I'm lucky that I work with some amazing folks that we all get along with, but it definitely required a mindset shift when I very first got started with it. So it's an interesting dynamic.
So like the family where I train, I'm there in their home twice a week. And then, so I train their mom, and then I train their youngest son. And then their second born and the dad, which would periodically pop in and out, right? But then it's funny because sometimes the youngest or second born forgets to put the plates back in the rack, or they forget the barbell in the rack, and their mom, who I jokingly say is basically a firm version of Mary Poppins.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So yesterday she was like saying, "Hey Mark, can you tell like my youngest that he better clean up?" Because I already knew it was his, because he sent me the videos for me to review. And then I said, "Sure." So I said, "I'm gonna do this. If it's your training day and I see that, I'm gonna tell him he has to send me a video of 100 swings." So we were laughing about it yesterday. So
amazing.
She was saying, "Yeah," and it's a good dynamic. So, but yeah, it's I would say a different skill set training people in home. I mean, now that you mentioned it, because yeah, when they go to you, it's like you're the boss. But when you go in there, it's like you're coming in there to serve them more than they come to you for your skill set. So it's definitely meeting someone halfway, more importantly.
For sure. Yeah, and you always just want to respect people and respect their homes.
Yeah.
You know? So you can't get but so mean and up in their face.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's
unless maybe that's negotiated otherwise. But yeah.
Oh yeah. It has to be something written under contract.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's funny. Yeah, sometimes, you know, the house is unlocked, you know, just come on in. And so here I am just pulling up to a random house, walking directly in the door. And of course, I'm always in black, usually in a sweatshirt or, you know, a hoodie or a jacket or something. I look like I'm coming to rob your house.
Exactly, yeah. Especially if you're wearing sweatpants and you have like a beanie on, which you could just drop down.
Exactly. So I kind of like look around, make sure that, like, you know, the neighbors are, you know, giving me any weird looks. Like, it's okay, I'm just a personal trainer. I'm not robbing the house. It's okay.
Yeah, they know me. They know me. And I mean, yeah, especially in Nashville, because it's, I mean, a more rural city in the United States.
Of course. Of course.
And I mean, given that you've, how long have you been there? 7, 8 years now?
Yeah, just about eight.
Yeah, and I mean, especially because, I mean, with my limited knowledge of the U.S., I mean, you don't exactly sound Southern, so that's definitely another thing, another story for another time.
Right, exactly.
So yeah, they know you're cool, not local.
Yeah, right. Well, hey, I'm curious to specifically, this is a little bit selfish on my part, but as some folks out there may know, one of the, again, we were talking about, you know, you don't need the newest, fanciest tool in the toolbox to upgrade your training. But one decidedly old school training tool that I got into a number of years ago was the pec stick.
Yeah.
And I eventually created kind of a vault of pec stick exercises and kind of concepts for how to use it to supercharge some of your other movement patterns and whatnot. And yeah, I know that you have been working with the pec stick yourself. So do tell, how do you incorporate it into your training? What do you like about it? What have you found to be any benefits?
So what's interesting is a lot of people are familiar with it. And of course, they just think you bend it or whatnot. Then when I show them that there are a lot of ways to play with it, it gets them curious. Now, at the same time, the one thing that is such low-hanging fruit for it is it does not give that feeling of intimidation to anyone. So like going back to the family I train, I have the mom use a 20-pound pec stick and she finds it very fun. So, I mean, if I could have someone who's basically old enough to be our mom do that, I think it would be a lot easier to have people in our age group try it out, because it doesn't have that intimidation factor. So I like that. And you teach it, it teaches you how to really like set your feet, how to brace if you're sitting down on the couch. So it gives you a lot of these details that you would have that would take you so much longer to teach and or to learn, just because it you're already right there, so the lesson happens by default.
Love that. Yeah, it's fun. And when people kind of see it done, it really triggers something. It's like, oh, let me try that. Let me see this. And that's what we see a lot of times, like with you know, the grip dynamometers or the grippers. People are like, I want to see how I stack up on this thing. And it's an example of a resistance-based movement that is not weight-based.
Yes.
Which again, by default, kind of makes it less intimidating.
And one thing about, like, let's say, since you also touched on the grippers, we all know that grip strength is also one of the indicators they say for longevity, right? So that's another thing I often use to tell people why they should strength train. Is I said, when you're in your 40s and up, especially if you're 60 and up, a lot of the time, getting stronger, putting on some muscle is not about vanity anymore. It's about staying as young as you can.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Fight. The fight against gravity is one that we all have to contend with. And the more muscle you got, the better.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't mean that you have to be massive like the Hulk, but it means at least like, but have a decent amount, because that's what's going to keep you young.
Yeah, obviously, as much as possible without resorting to illicit substances.
Oh, yeah, of course. But then again, there are people who, let's say, have a certain condition who might need a prescription. That's a different story, of course. We get that.
Of course. Well, cool, man. Well, let's see. What is on your calendar for the year? I know you mentioned that you are heading up to Tokyo, which...
Yeah, so yeah, let me pop up my calendar really quickly. So today is the 4th of March here in Manila, 3rd of March there in Nashville. All right, here we go. Opening my calendar. Okay, so on the 5th, that I fly out to India on the 12th because I'm going to be assisting at a workshop, a kettlebell workshop.
Oh, great.
15 to 17, yeah. April 21 and 28, we will be doing a kettlebell workshop here in Manila. And May, I have to check. We might have another workshop, maybe in the northern part of the Philippines. So I'm going to have to ask my friend Reg to confirm with our friends over there at FNB if we're going to do another workshop there. So that's it. And then June rolls in. We'll see what happens from there.
Cool. Well, glad to hear that you're keeping up with workshops.
Yeah, it's a good way to get people interested in movement, and it's also a good way to network, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I obviously Liftapalooza was the big project, you know, that we try to do every winter, and
yeah,
obviously I tried to get in at least a few training workshops throughout the year, and they're always so much fun. You always
it is, yeah.
You always learn, I think, as much or more teaching as you do, you know, being a participant, which for us as coaching nerds is really special.
Yeah, because like especially if you're teaching them one movement and then this usual teaching progression just doesn't click with one or two of the attendees, and you try something else and suddenly it makes a big difference, and you take note of that. Oh, so for this scenario, this is a better approach.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like you get all these guinea pigs to help you workshop out your own ideas.
Yes, exactly. So they're helping us as much as we are helping them.
That is it. Well, cool, man. Well, let's see. I want to say, you know, how much I appreciate you being out there and spreading the good word about kettlebells. You know, it's always funny. I think every time I go on the Strong First forums, which is probably not as often as I maybe should to be a contributing member of the community, but I always see like you in there, helping answer people's questions and giving perspectives and your thoughts on people's questions. And that's super cool. And that's another part of just helping people, you know,
getting
in there on the forums and answering questions. And it's always cool to see your name pop up around the forums.
I appreciate that. And it's also, as you said, one way of giving back, because when for the listeners, before we had social media, we had the message boards, and I got a lot out of it in so many ways. So for me, doing that is just my way of giving back.
Love it. Well, good deal, Mark. Well, let's see. Anything else to announce or point people to before we wrap up? You're on Instagram. You're on social media.
Yeah, I'm very easy to find. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. I'm also on TikTok. My X, which was formerly known as Twitter, it's semi-active. That's where I'm least active. But Facebook and Instagram, I'm easily accessible. Just hit me up if you have any questions or whatnot.
Dig it. All right, on Mark. Well, hey, keep up the good work. And by one way or another, I hope our paths cross in person sometime in the future.
Yeah, hopefully it does. That would be the day.
Oh, yeah. Well, good stuff, sir. We'll chat again here real soon.
Yes, sir. See you around.